Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
It was clear from the start that Stuart's trial would be complicated. He gave himself up immediately, as we learned in the last episode. But even so, and even with the camera footage of the shooting itself, the trial, which didn't start until spring of 2004, would drag on for months once it was finally underway. The prosecution argued that this was an open and shut case, that Stuart was a bully who'd finally taken things too far. But the defense maintained that Stuart had been driven to his actions by Jean Hillary's overzealous fixation on the Santos Linguiça sausage factory. That was coupled with Stuart not being in his right mind the day of the shooting due to undiagnosed mental health issues related to repeated head injuries sustained throughout his life. Both sides argued for months, but there could only be one conclusion. I could try to maintain some suspense, but this case is over 2 decades old. If you haven't Googled it by now, I'd be surprised. If not, I'll keep the results to myself until the end. From KCBS Radio and Odyssey, I'm Natalia Gurevich, and this is The Sausage King. Episode 6, The Past is Fair Play.
Certain things I remember as if it was yesterday.
Like what?
Well, how difficult it was to get the trial going, number one, because the defense attorney was an obstructionist.
What does that mean?
So, for example, there were multiple, over 20 videos, and I think over, 5,000 photos? Because not only was the state police, city police involved, but the feds were involved too because of the two federal agents. So, I mean, it was videoed beyond belief, and he objected to every photograph, every video. So it took us a while, maybe 3-4 months, just to get through all the photographs, all the evidence. I like to start a trial with letting the attorneys know what's coming in, what's not coming in, so that they know, they can prepare, they know, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but, and then during the trial, there was an objection to everything. So
that's Judge Vernon Nakahara. We know him. He's been in and out of this podcast more times than I can count by now. He was the judge on the case and revealed that my cousin, the owner of a small hot dog chain, testified at Stuart's trial. Vernon was one of my first interviews for this podcast in August of last year. We met at his house in Oakland and opted to sit in his lush backyard because it was such a nice day. At a patio table, we watched as his spry, gray and white cat Nellie caught a songbird in her surprisingly strong grasp, only to let it fly away seconds later. Vernon was appointed as a judge in Alameda County in 1989, then elevated to Superior Court judge in 1995. While he mostly oversaw family court cases, divorces, custody battles, by the time Stuart's case landed on his desk, he'd dealt with 3 or 4 other capital cases. But what stood out to him at the time, and even now, all these years later, was the video.
Well, let me describe it this way. You know the basic facts of the case.
Yeah.
They want to inspect. He won't let them. Mm-hmm. Turns on the video. He starts loading his gun. And he comes out and he shoots all three of them in the waiting room. And then he goes out after old Willis, who was waiting for the police to come because they called the police, try to get him to cooperate. And then so he starts running after old Willis and doesn't shoot him, comes back, and then puts another bullet in their heads. And that's the one, I think, the jurors thought, no, that's not right. Mm-hmm. And you could see it on the video. And, you know, the joke around the judges was, well, anybody can try a case with a video. Nakahara, what's the big deal here? You know, it's sort of, you know, sick humor, but that video is awful. Because when we showed it on the video in front of the jurors, I mean, there were 15 jurors crying.
Yeah.
I mean, it was awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen some pretty tough cases, and boy, that choked me up a little. That and during the penalty phase when the victims came in to testify about the impact, the victim impact statements.
Mm-hmm.
It was awful, I gotta tell you.
Hearing the statements from Jean Hillary's daughters and the family of the other victims was especially hard for Vernon. He said you could hear a pin drop in the courtroom when they were speaking, as well as when Earl Willis gave his testimony, which we heard last episode.
So, yeah, it was long and arduous. I think it was the longest death penalty case I've had.
Really? Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that.
Because usually it's a lot shorter.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot shorter.
So, you know, while the proceedings are going on, I'm kind of curious what it was like every day to hear, you know, new evidence, new arguments. Did your perspective shift at all during the proceedings?
Well, not really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because we had such a long pre-jury session to go over all the evidence, you got to look at everything.
Mm-hmm.
You got to see the video, you know, stuff like that. The perspective is, you know, I can say he's guilty, he's not guilty, it's not my decision.
Mm. Okay.
And I go in with an open view about, you know, prosecution screws up, they screw up, defense screws up, they screw up. You try to protect them both. But, you know, in death penalty cases, you usually get pretty good boys. So they're not green. They know how to, they know the evidence code. So it makes it a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
A lot easier, believe me.
Yeah.
You get some, you know, greenhorn attorneys in there, and it's so hard. And you have to be, I'm a patient man, and you have to be so patient. But with those death penalty cases, it's usually pretty good lawyers.
The attorneys on the case were Paul Hora and Jack Leitner for the prosecution, and Michael Ogle and Jason Clay for the defense. I was able to speak to one from each team for this podcast. Paul Hora is still around in Alameda County, now an assistant district attorney at the East County Hall of Justice. He popped up briefly in our first episode when I was summarizing what happened. He was also one of my first interviews for this story. When he agreed to meet me, he invited me over to the Wiley W. Manuel Courthouse in Oakland, that has its own recording studio in its basement. After walking through a short subterranean maze to get there, we were led into a soundproof room, equipped with everything needed for the obligatory press conference or TV appearance people in his role have to endure. Paul has the polished air of someone who's done countless media appearances in his life, and this wasn't even his first appearance for this case. He'd grown up eating the linguiça, at family barbecues and for breakfast on weekends, but he didn't know much about the family itself until the shooting hit the news. Then he was assigned the case.
No, I really didn't know anything about the family because
okay.
I was just a kid.
Okay.
I just ate the linguiça.
Okay.
And then my next sort of connect, other than eating the sausage, my next sort of connection or intersection with the whole factory and the family was when I was assigned the case.
Okay.
I did, obviously, I remember reading about it and seeing it on TV, the mm-hmm. murders, because it was big news yeah. when it happened. But until I was assigned the case, that's when I really, you know, opened me up to the family, and I learned all mm-hmm. about them.
Okay.
Very well, actually.
I mean, I can imagine.
Yeah. Cases like that are pretty intense.
Yeah, can you kind
they
of...
consume you.
Yeah, can you expand on that a little bit? What made this case so different from, say, the others you'd handled so far in your career?
Well, it was the first capital case, mm-hmm. first and only capital case, actually, that I've ever tried. Mm-hmm. And so the case went... It was a little unusual because there was both federal and state jurisdiction. And ultimately, the district attorney at the time, Tom Orloff, and the U.S. attorney at the time made an agreement that he would be prosecuted here first mm-hmm. in state court. And then it was going to, the plan was it was going to be prosecuted in federal court mm-hmm. after the state court prosecution. Because the rules of double jeopardy allowed that to happen, but the reverse isn't true. In other words, it couldn't be prosecuted in federal court and then prosecuted in California.
Mm-hmm.
So the agreement was made to prosecute the case here first in Alameda County. Jack Leitner, who was a U.S. attorney, was assigned to the case from the U.S. attorney's office, deputized as an Alameda County deputy district attorney, and was my partner on the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only case I've ever had where I actually had another lawyer help me.
I asked Paul to describe the security footage again because I hadn't been able to get my hands on it myself, and he'd had to view it several times over the course of the case. I figured his memory would be fairly accurate, even 21 years later.
It's in black and white, and there's no audio. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just horrifying watching it. It's unbelievable. It begins with him climbing off a ladder in his office because he had a false ceiling, and the video recorder was actually in the ceiling. So the video comes on as he's replacing the tile where that hides the VCR, and then he steps down the ladder and walks around the office and walks kind of anxiously for a few minutes. And then you can see there might have been four cameras, but I know at least two. I'd have to look at it again. It's been a while. Mm-hmm. The main view of the video is there's a video in his office, so you can see what he's doing. And his office is just a few steps away from the, I'll call it the customer area or the showroom where customers walk in and purchase product. And you can see the inspectors just waiting unknowingly for him on the second video screen.
Mm-hmm.
And he loads up three guns and walks out there and guns them down.
Mm-hmm.
And then realizes there's a fourth inspector outside, and he runs outside. That's not on video, and shoots, chasing the fourth inspector down the street. That was Earl Willis, who worked for the state of California. And then he comes back in to the showroom, and the three inspectors are on the floor. I remember at least Jean Hillary, who was the woman inspector, was still moving.
Mm-hmm.
And he reloads the gun and shoots each one of them in the head. Mm-hmm. It's just words can't describe it.
Yeah.
It was awful.
Because the video was available, it made the charges levied against Stewart pretty cut and dry. The main charges were three counts of murder with a special circumstance of multiple murder. There was also the special circumstance of killing a government official, and there was a count of attempted murder on Earl Willis. All of these charges made Stewart eligible for the death penalty.
The fact that he committed the crime and pulled the trigger was cut and dry, yes. There was no question about that. The question becomes his mental state at the time he committed the crime and whether or not that was first-degree murder or second-degree murder or a manslaughter potentially. Mm-hmm. I was convinced that it was a first-degree murder.
Paul's job was to convince the jury to agree with him that this was first-degree murder. In order to do so, all of Stuart's life, everything, was fair play.
So then my next question is, you know, what did you learn about what was going on in his life that kind of helped you facilitate getting that those 12 people to make that decision?
The crime itself, I thought, carried enough, was just so powerful and such an awful act. And it was clearly premeditated. He had no remorse. I thought that was the biggest or the most significant factor, I think, that weighed in favor of his punishment ultimately by the jury. There was some evidence of violence in his past, mm-hmm. and now I'm stretching on memory here, but there was at one point he owned a piece of property in San Leandro that he used to work for Oakland Scavenger Company, which was the garbage company, like waste management back in the day. He left that company and started his own business where he hauled junk. And eventually he was kicked out of or not allowed to dump his junk at the waste management facility. So what he started to do was dump his junk on his property. And there was an older man who lived next door to that property who got tired of living next to a bunch of junk and one day was taking photographs of the junk over the fence. Stuart saw him do that, and Stuart went over and confronted the man and punched him a few times in the head, seriously injured him. I want to say broke his jaw or maybe knocked him out. There are definitely court records on that too. Mm-hmm. And broke the man's camera. So I remember that act of violence that was introduced at trial to prove that he had committed violence in the past, or handled his, it was sort of a pattern for him that when he would get angry and things weren't going his way, he would, if he had to, resort to violence.
That was a major event that stood out to Paul about the trial. The violence Stuart had demonstrated in beating up his elderly neighbor, Clifford Berg. We learned about that in episode 4, when Stuart tried to run for mayor. There was also some discussion about what Stuart's mental health issues might be, and if there was any evidence he was being treated unfairly by the USDA. But ultimately, Paul came to the conclusion that Stuart was responsible for his actions, and that was the end of it.
He had written several emails and talked to several people about killing the inspectors and grinding them up and making sausage out of them. We had some emails, actually, that he had written in the months leading up to the murders, where he had fantasized about committing crimes. And you know, nobody really took them very seriously. But unfortunately, you know, he ended up doing what he did. Mm-hmm. But he sort of, I don't know if spoiled brat is the right word, but he just, that's my impression of him. He was sort of a bully.
One man who disagrees with Paul is, of course, Stuart's defense attorney, Michael Ogle. Michael's courtroom presence has been described in past media coverage, and by Judge Nakahara himself, as a bit on the pushy side, perhaps a bit aggressive. When I interviewed him, I didn't find this to be the case. Instead, the man I met with seemed passionately dedicated to his case and his client, and still felt strongly about the course of events that occurred decades later. Now semi-retired and based in Sacramento, Michael occasionally offers his services as a consultant. He is thin, wiry, with curly salt and pepper hair that he had on that day pulled back into a ponytail. He has a sharp gaze and a firm, deliberate manner of speaking. Like any good attorney, he came prepared. But before we got into it, first things first. Michael made it very clear at the beginning of the interview what his position was in regards to his client, even 21 years later.
I'm not allowed to tell you anything about my impressions about Stuart or anything that was communicated between us or confidentially in any other context in the case.
While Michael refused to divulge information about his impressions of Stuart or what the two of them discussed, he did go into detail about what he learned about Stuart's background, which ultimately helped inform his main arguments for the case.
I mean, we have to understand the context of this case. This was case was not a case about who did what, right? I mean, Stuart obviously killed these people. The question was why, the little intricate details about what was happening at the time, and if we ever got to a punishment phase, to a kind of understanding some of Stuart's background, which led him to the more macro why as opposed to the micro why. And so we did investigate and present the narrative, the story of essentially Stuart's life, his family background.
And Michael outlined a lot of what we already know. And he drew some of the same conclusions that I have as I've been working on this story the last several months.
Their linguisa was revered. Among the records that I reviewed were mail orders and correspondence from people all across the country who would ask for their order their linguisa. And actually, there were a lot of people upset after this happened because they could no longer get the linguisa. It was a... how should we say it, that the factory was a source of pride, great pride in the family. From the outside, physically, it didn't look like much. I mean, it just looked like a tiny shop in kind of a quasi-industrial part of town. But the point being that... So Herman Tweedy was a quote-unquote big man. He had a lot of popularity, identity. Tweedy was known for having affairs. He was known for not giving Stuart or probably even Stanley, his younger brother, a whole lot of love. The big thing... that he did with his kids. The two big things he did with his kids were, one, have them work at the linguisa factory long hours after school. So Stuart was doing that from a very early age. And two, they would have Sunday afternoon boxing matches on the lawn in front of the house. And so Tweedy really valued, A, working for the family business, and B, showing how tough you are in these family boxing matches. And so the way Stuart was raised, those kind of became the two most important things. As I said, Tweedy didn't give Stuart or probably Stanley a whole lot of love. And Stuart was always trying to earn his love or make his father proud of him, if you will. And that reality was part of why he ended up killing these people.
This was part of Michael's strategy, to show the jurors how Stuart's childhood shaped him into this person who was trying and ultimately failing to uphold his family's legacy. The second part was asserting Stuart had endured multiple head injuries over the course of his life.
There's one thing his father was proud of him for, because he was really good in the family boxing matches with his older brother and with dad. And at some point, Stuart actually got in the ring. And so that's where he suffered the concussions, was in actual more real boxing matches, if you will.
So he was like an amateur boxer for a time?
Yes.
Really? Okay. So from what ages or how long?
I think like late teens, early adult, probably right after high school.
Okay.
Did he have like a name or something like that?
No, I mean, he never, as far as I can recall, never really had any great stardom. I mean, never fought in a big venue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of more like, you know, AAU type stuff or.
Okay, interesting. So the 5 concussions were sustained during that period, and I mean.
Well, not just from that. He also had an extremely severe auto accident.
Oh, really? Okay, when was that?
That was closer in time to the killings. like many people, well, all right. Nowadays we have a small portion of the population, too big of a portion of the population that is, you know, anti-masking. You're not going to tell me to wear a mask. You're not going to tell me to get a vaccine. When in the 70s, in 80s, we had a portion of the population that wasn't too into seatbelts. Okay, and motorcycle riders, one's helmets, not into wearing helmets, right? Anyway, Stewart, at least for a portion of his life, was not wearing seatbelts. So he was driving on the freeway one day, kind of in rush hour traffic, being a little aggressive and trying to go fast and changing lanes without a seatbelt, and he had a bad crash. And you have a bad crash going 65 miles an hour and you're not wearing a seatbelt, bad things happen. So he smashed his head on against the windshield, lost consciousness, went to the hospital. And so that was another example. And he did, in fact, have lingering physical permanent brain injury, traumatic brain injury that was documented and presented at the trial.
A head injury after a crash is pretty common. But I was curious how an amateur boxing career might have impacted Stewart's behavior even before the shootings. I spoke with Dr. Carlin Center, the director of Primary Care Sports Medicine Service at UCSF, about how concussions caused by sports injuries like boxing can impact mental health and behavior. Other sports, like football, hockey, and wrestling, are high-risk sports for concussions. But boxing hasn't been studied to the same extent.
But we know that boxing is, you know, that boxers are at risk for, obviously, head trauma and long-term neuropsychological problems from head trauma.
Okay.
No doubt. So it's definitely a high-risk sport with respect to concussion.
Okay. So I'm kind of wondering, would you say that the understanding of how to best treat these types of injuries in the short term has improved in recent years?
Yeah, I think we've learned so much about concussion in the last, say, 15, 20 years in terms of how to treat concussion, how to make sure that someone's recovered before they go back.
But even with all of the advancements of the last 20 years or so, there's still a lot of uncertainty as to how concussions can affect cognitive function.
In the vast majority of people, we don't think that they have brain damage from concussion, which is an amazing thing about brain injury in general, is that the brain has amazing healing capacity.
Okay.
And so the vast majority of people we don't think have any long-term consequences from concussion, whether they've had 1 or 3 or 5. The studies that raise concern about chronic neuropsychological problems after head injury, for the most part, these involve athletes who suffered thousands, maybe tens of thousands of hits to their okay. head, neck, or body. And so it's probably a different phenomenon. You know, when we start talking about the phenomenon of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what boxers have been shown to develop from head trauma, and what a number of professional football players and hockey players have been found to have on brain autopsies. chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, for the most part, has been found in athletes who've had a lot of collision in their sport for many, many years, for the most part, you know, even into a professional career. So it's we haven't seen that in folks who are recreational athletes, nor in people who've, you know, played high school, middle school sports. So we don't think that the vast majority of people who have concussion, sport concussion, will not have long-term problems from it.
Okay. Okay. That's definitely good to know. a little relieving.
Yeah.
So then, I guess then where do you start to see that occur? Like you say, like, you know, thousands of little hits, but does it have to be like of that magnitude, or can there be damage, you know, say from, I don't know, like 3 concussions or 4 concussions,
right?
5 concussions, you know?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's an unanswered question and under active study. So there's a big study going on right now in the NCAA and Department of Defense looking at athletes with concussion and trying to sort out what is the consequence of head injury over time and what are the changes that occur and that sort of thing. But we really don't know. We don't know the dose, you know, the dose of head injury that leads to you know, long-term consequences.
Huh, really? After all this time, we still don't really know.
No. Many questions to be answered.
The experts that Michael consulted at the trial confirmed his suspicions that Stuart had suffered some brain damage from, if not his injuries, at least from the car accident.
So most of the time, the only thing we know is, okay, people, and sometimes does a person even really know that they lost consciousness, right? But that's kind of the sign of a brain injury. But most times there's no, like, how should we say, physical proof of how severe the brain injury is, especially years down the road. So, for example, a lot of things will never show up in an X-ray. Some things will show up in an MRI, but most things won't. Most brain injuries will not show up in an MRI. In the early 2000s, there was a new procedure starting to be developed called functional MRI, little f, capital MRI, that was a little more able to detect organic or physical brain injury. But Stewart's was so bad that when he was examined with a generic MRI that normally will not detect truly present brain injury, it revealed that. It showed the lesions in his brain. In a conventional brain MRI, which is pretty rare. So, for example, we didn't need to go to what they call a PET scan or a SPECT scan or fMRI or any of these more modern ways of injecting dyes and all that kind of thing. The amount of his damage to his brain was so severe that an expert testified at the trial that he was essentially in the bottom 1% of the population in terms of his brain matter.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means, like, for example, there's, I'll use an analogy to the issue of intellectual disability, mental retardation, mm-hmm. right? So there's things called standard deviations, which is how you measure whether or not a person's an average or if they're marginally intellectually disabled or whether they're severely intellectually disabled. So And that's kind of primarily based on IQ testing and adaptive deficits, organic brain damage in terms of missing gray matter. I mean, just not there. You could basically see holes in his brain because of the damage. This is what was apparent, holes or lesions. Yeah. This is what was apparent on the MRI. And the statistical analysis by our expert, Dr. Aaron Bigler, from at the time Brigham Young University, who is at the forefront of doing quantitative analysis of MRIs and brain injuries, documented that he was literally in the bottom 1% of the population in terms of the structural integrity of his brain.
So like in layman's terms, how would that sort of present itself physically, the symptoms of that kind of damage?
Okay, that's a good question. So in other words, what does this matter, or what does it do?
How would it affect you in your daily life? Yeah.
So basically, in his case, his frontal lobes were very damaged, and your frontal lobes control executive functioning, and so they, the real life consequences of his brain damage were, he had poor impulse control, he had difficulty. Balancing competing considerations. He was perseverative. In other words, once he has an idea in his head, even if the idea is not working, he's going to keep trying it as opposed to shifting and trying another way around to get to his goal, if you will. So those are some of the manifestations, if you will.
Okay. And if somebody was dealing with these kinds of, you know, brain damage today, what treatment do you think could have helped him at that time?
As far as I'm aware, well, let's put it this way. So, first of all, those consequences or manifestations or impacts essentially causes brain to be like an adolescent.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've learned in recent years, the last 20 years, a lot of brain science has shown us the realities about adolescent brains. The frontal lobes and the prefrontal cortex are not fully developed, which is why teenagers do a lot of impulsive things, which is why they don't really weigh the consequences, which is why they maybe perseverate about things, okay? What we know for teenagers is not like giving them some magic pill or medical treatment to get them to handle those issues better. It's just we nurture their growth so that they can eventually become more mature and handle situations more intelligently. So I would say based on what we know now or knew then, that a therapeutic intervention would have been best for Stuart, as it wasn't anything like, giving him a magic pill or anything. But that's what I would suggest, to put it bluntly.
Whatever Stuart was dealing with in terms of brain damage or mental illness, this was compounded by the desire to keep his family's legacy alive. And when he took over his family's factory at a time when USDA regulations were changing, he felt that this was threatened. I reached out to the USDA to get their comment on what happened, and they ultimately declined to participate in the podcast, sending a general statement instead to be attributed to a USDA Food Safety and Inspection Service spokesperson.
The deaths of FSIS investigators Gene Hillary and Tom Quadros and California investigator Bill Schaling 21 years ago was a tragedy. And we are forever grateful for the dedication that these investigators showed in their duty to protect public health. FSIS employees are some of the nation's most committed public health servants, and the agency appreciates the role our investigators and inspection personnel play every day to ensure that American families enjoy safe and wholesome meat, poultry, and egg products. FSIS does not tolerate workplace violence and is committed to the safety of all employees. The prevention of workplace violence is a top priority. the agency's Workplace Violence Prevention and Response Program was established to produce and implement actions to guard against similar attacks within FSIS and at federally regulated establishments. Through this program, employees have the opportunity to learn how to protect themselves. The program has a 24-hour toll-free helpline so that employees can report threats and incidents of workplace violence at any time of the day or night. Furthermore, employees have access to a workplace violence liaison and intervention officers at the headquarters and district level.
Although the USDA did not respond to my request for comment in regards to this podcast, I was able to get a good amount of information from the court transcript and from Paul and Michael. Both had surprisingly good memories of the case, more than two decades later, although Michael had a more colorful recollection of the events leading up to the shooting.
For whatever reason, a woman who was recently promoted, I believe in professional women, I'm married to a professional woman, but Jean Hillary, who was one of the victims, and she was clearly a victim, she was killed that day. She had been a career secretary in the USDA through a, you know, if you want to call it an affirmative action program for women, that would be roughly accurate. But she was promoted into an inspector role, and she was acting as the lead compliance officer for the USDA in their investigation of Stewart. And she really wanted to shut him down. Okay, and she was as passionate as Stewart was about Santos Linguiza, she was passionate about shutting him down. And it kind of became a little war, if you will, right? I mean, it literally erupted in firepower, right? You know, so she's trying to shut him down, and to shut it down would kill him because that's his identity. That's his life. That's the only thing he has to live for, really. It got to the point where the way they came down on him on that day was very heavy-handed. She violated her own instructions from her own boss, who told her and made clear, we have it in writing, it was presented at the trial, do not go there to give him in lay terms, a cease and desist order, if you will, without police escort. Do not do that. Do not confront him without police escort, because he was known to be a hothead. He was known to be volatile, which was consistent with his impulsivity and brain damage and issues I've already told you about, right? And so they knew what they were getting into, but she pushed him anyway.
I asked him how the battle between Stewart and Jean really started, as I wasn't able to get any information out of the USDA.
Jean Hillary and the USDA, and not just Jean Hillary, but before her, telling them, like, you're not in compliance with our rules and our regulations. You're not allowed to operate. You're not allowed to sell your product. The theoretical concern was that people could die from eating sausage or linguica that because it hadn't been smoked or cooked to a sufficient temperature to kill all potential bacteria. And Stewart's response was, well, I tried that, I did that at your level, and it just dries out the linguica. It becomes like beef jerky. And our product we sell on the label says cook before eating. And so it's meant to be cooked. It's not meant to be eaten raw. So this is a non-issue. So why are you jerking my chain, essentially? And with a previous director basically had, if memory serves, had basically said, okay, just as long as that label's there, cook before eating, we're good, or it'll be all right. But it became not okay, if you will, and it became more and more demanding. You can't sell your stuff, and He was definitely selling his stuff. He was definitely going against their directives. Because, again, as we see a lot of people in society right now in various contexts, it's like, what I'm doing, there's nothing wrong with it. It's, no one's getting hurt. This is the right way to do it. Don't tell me how to do this, because if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
His account lines up with what information I'd been able to glean from multiple interviews with others who knew about the issues, that Stewart was still smoking the Linguisa the way it had always been done, even though regulations had changed since he'd taken over the factory. That, coupled with his refusal to accommodate these updates, created friction. But based on accounts from other sausage makers, like Nick Nicosia, and people close to the issue, like Earl Willis's wife Renee, Stewart could have worked with the inspectors. They could have come up with solutions to the problem together. This is part of the inspector's role, to help these businesses continue functioning. I wasn't able to get more information from the USDA, but California's Department of Food and Agriculture did respond to my request for more information about this case. I was able to speak with them over Zoom as the Delta variant was surging in the Bay Area last fall.
My name's Annette Jones. I'm the state veterinarian and the director for Animal Health and Food Safety Services at the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And I've been fortunate enough to be with the department for just over 17 years. So I joined the department shortly after the tragic loss of the inspectors related to the meat facility.
Dr. Jones joined the department that Bill Shaleen and Earl Willis had worked for in the years immediately after the shooting at Santos Linguisa.
And when I first started, it was fairly somber at work. And you can tell that people really had been impacted in a way that really surprised them. You know, we're the Department of Food and Agriculture. We work with farmers and ranchers and processors. And, you know, everybody knows that you just never can anticipate when things go tragically wrong. You know, we all know that that could happen. But I think it was very shocking to our culture and our staff members when we did suffer those losses. And, you know, I can remember my boss relaying that, you know, he thought, you know, he would never change. He'd never fully recover from it.
When he said that he wouldn't be able to recover from it, what did he mean by that?
Well, just when you work with people every day, you're not just colleagues. You become friends with them. You get to learn a little bit about their families. And then when they lose their life in such an unexpected way, especially associated with work, it's hard to shake that. You know, you always feel an element of loss. You know, you just miss them like anybody would miss someone that passes. But you also, there's that other, you know, is there something we could have done? You know, could we have prevented this? So there's that, you know, that questioning that you carry with you.
Dr. Jones' supervisor had more of a working relationship with Bill Shaleen, the state inspector who died in the shooting.
Did your boss ever kind of tell you a little bit about Bill or anything about, you know, what he was like to work with?
Yeah, actually not just him, but his other colleagues. You know, just a nice guy, you know, always willing to do, you know, to go the extra mile, do what needs to be done. Kind of a regular guy they really liked working with.
Dr. Jones wasn't familiar with the reasoning behind the USDA's decision to bring the state inspectors into the situation, as it was before her time. But even though she'd never met Bill herself, nor was she part of the department at the time of the shooting, she attended Stewart's sentencing.
I'm curious, why did you decide to go to the sentencing hearing?
You know, I was thinking about that myself. I think I felt like I owed it, even though I was a pretty new employee, I think I felt like I just owed it to the family, all the families involved. And it was something I just felt like we should be present for.
Was anyone else from the department there?
I'm sure there was, but I actually can't remember. It was so long ago now. I'm positive there was. I just don't remember who.
Okay. Yeah. No. That's fair. It's been 21 years. I mean, what besides it being, you know, a really sobering event, what were your major takeaways from the sentencing hearing?
It's when you know, when someone's getting sentenced and it's a life or death sentence for the crime of murder, you know, I read the newspaper or what do we do now? We look at it on, you know, whatever medium we use. But so I follow the news and I've seen, you know, you hear about murder every day. But I personally, you know, I've been fortunate. I haven't really been touched by it other than this event. And you hear, you know, the consequences of crimes like that. But I think until, I mean, sobering is the best term, because when you see it, the reality is, it's difficult to use words to describe it, but it is very impactful.
Based on the evidence, the witness testimonies, the prosecution's arguments, Stewart was sentenced for all three murders and given the death penalty. During the trial and before his sentencing, Stewart had been held in Santa Rita Jail in Dublin. By the time the trial had rolled around, he was in bad shape. He had gained a lot of weight, ballooned in size dramatically, shocking those who knew him when he first appeared in the courtroom. According to Michael, Stewart's attorney, this was mainly due to the medical treatment he was receiving for his mental health issues.
And he certainly met the standard. He was on medication throughout the trial, antipsychotic medications, to kind of help him address his underlying mental health issues, if you will. And that definitely seemed to help. It unfortunately had a really bad side effect, which caused him to gain over 100 pounds, which actually ultimately killed him. Because he had ballooned up and he died of a coronary embolism, which apparently was related to his largesse at the time.
Michael couldn't remember what medication Stewart had been prescribed, but knew that it was meant to help with his client's mental decline.
He suffered from some serious psychotic breakdowns in custody. Somebody who certainly enjoyed freedom, being outside. His whole life was basically being outside, except for working in the sausage factory, because, you know, being a garbage man, sanitation worker, that's outside work. Doing hauling is outside work. He was trying to develop a property that he was leasing with an eye towards buying it. And that was all outside work. He was working on the houses that he was trying to buy or maintain. Again, all outside work. So he was somebody who was always outside, and being in custody, essentially single cell, kind of drove him even more crazy, if you would. I mean, he had his organic damage issues, but he really lost it, as came out in trial, so I can talk about this. He decompensated so much at one point that when he was on suicide watch and not allowed to have clothes even, and it was just in a smock, he was making marbles out of his feces and playing marbles in his cell with his feces, you know, that he had made into marbles. And I don't care what anybody says about anything, if you're doing that, you are messed up. Okay? So, the medication, how shall I say, resulted in him no longer being suicidal, resulted in him in no longer engaging in behaviors like the one I described, and allowed him to be calm and sort of placid, maybe a little bit numb throughout the trial. I mean, antipsychotics do tend to numb people, if you will. I mean, that's the kind of they're less emotive, if you will.
Despite the arguments from the defense about Stewart's past head trauma and his deteriorating mental health, The jurors sided with the arguments put forth by the prosecution, outlined in Paul Hora's closing arguments.
The reason we find ourselves here today in this courtroom is because of the actions of one man, and he's sitting right there between his lawyers. Stuart Charles Alexander made deliberate choices on June 21st, 2000. And those deliberate choices are the reason why we're here. And of course, that fateful day on June 21st, 2000, will probably go down in San Leandro's history as one of its deadliest. Certainly dark and dreadful. Now, Mr. Alexander was the only one who pulled the trigger. And he pulled the trigger at least 18 times. At least 18 times. And he did it with 3 firearms. And he shot at 4 human beings. Now, we know from the evidence that 3 of those slugs penetrated the flesh of Tom Quadros. 4 of those slugs penetrated the flesh of Gene Hillary. And 6 of those slugs penetrated the flesh of Bill Schaling, a man he had met for the first time that day. He had only been there just a few minutes. Make no mistake about this, ladies and gentlemen. This was a mass murder. This was a mass murder by ambush. That's how the crime began. And then it ended as a mass murder by execution. That's what happened. Why? Because these 4 people were just doing their jobs. They were just doing their jobs. A noble job, I might add. A necessary one. We would all like to eat safe food. We would all like to eat wholesome food. We would all like to eat food that's properly labeled. Over the past 5.5 months, it's been a long time, I know. You've been presented with mountains of evidence. You've heard evidence sometimes over and over again. And that mountain of evidence that you have before you now clearly proves the defendant guilty of these charges beyond any reasonable doubt. There's no question about it. And of course, the most important piece of evidence you have in this case is thanks to the defendant. The execution is on videotape. You can watch it on TV. It's the defendant's snuff film, in effect. And that film demonstrates his willful, deliberate, and premeditated execution. Simply put, he planned these executions before he did it. Then he executed his plan, literally. And then after it was all said and done, he bragged about it. Now, as a result of those willful and deliberate choices that he made on June 21st, 2000, he finds himself here, charged with the crimes in the indictment that the judge has just read you.
Michael, Stewart's attorney, was frustrated by the death penalty verdict.
I mean, let's put it in elementary terms. I don't mean that as an insult, and I just
mean in
basic terms. So, according to the law, according to the United States Constitution, according to the conservative United States Supreme Court, which has been running, which has been the Supreme Court for the last 50 plus years, no matter how bad the crime, person cannot automatically be sentenced to death. Instead, you have to look to the whole of their life and just basically decide in the vernacular, is this person the worst of the worst? It's not, because you're not just punishing the crime if you give them the death penalty, you're extinguishing their life. So it's necessary to look at the person's life, and prosecutors like to argue, well, this person's an animal. They're not even human anymore. And conversely, the defense likes to try, the job is to try to show the jury the humanity of their client, right? The human values. And so the truth, as I said in the very beginning about my allegiance to the truth, the truth is that Stuart wasn't a cold-blooded executioner. He was a very damaged individual who acted reactively, impulsively, after he was provoked, and the suggestion was made to him to go out there and shoot. And this first shot was, in fact, a warning shot. The first shot was into the ceiling. The video shows that. And this was in response to people, or one person in particular, who was literally trying to kill his identity, not physically kill him, but kill his existence.
For the families of Stuart's victims, it was a small consolation. According to Renee, the wife of the only survivor, who we met in episode 5, there was simply a sense of relief that the ordeal was done.
I was relieved that Ogle's behavior didn't make anybody believe the truth.
What do you mean by behavior?
He was just, his mannerisms, just the way that he talked, it just made it, he was like trying to blame the victims.
Mm. Okay.
So that was not a good thing.
Renee is talking about Michael Ogle, Stuart's lawyer. His defense rubbed Renee the wrong way. By arguing that the inspectors had pushed Stuart to the point of snapping, she felt that Michael had been unfair to the people that Stuart had murdered.
And then as soon as I heard, I called Earl and told him what the verdict was.
How did he react?
He's glad the whole thing was over.
Yeah.
And only concern was, what was his sentence going to be? And we were relieved when he died.
Yeah.
Because no more taxpayer dollars being wasted on this person.
That's right. Stuart died before his sentence was fully carried out. While he was sentenced in late 2004, he died about a year later while on death row at San Quentin. Officially, the cause was a pulmonary embolism, likely due to his significant weight gain. Unofficially, I heard from one source, which has not been verified. A guard sat on Stuart's chest to subdue him when he was, quote, acting up, and Stuart's heart couldn't take the pressure. San Quentin's public information officer did not respond to my request for comment, and I couldn't find a formal complaint or any documentation to support this claim. Either way, Stuart passed away at only 44 years old. Just like that, the Sausage King was gone. And his factory went with him. The nearly 80-year legacy he wanted to protect was undone by his own actions, gone without so much as a single sausage left behind. Next time on The Sausage King, we finally meet our mystery sausage maker, who still makes the Santos Linguiça with the factory's original recipe. We'll uncover just how he came into possession of this recipe and what his connection was to Stuart. While speaking with him, we will learn more about Stuart's state of mind throughout his life and just before the killings.
I knew Stuart had a problem, mental.
Yeah.
My pay grade isn't high enough to accuse anybody of being anything except the fact that I've been around a long time and I've seen a lot. And symptoms are a big thing to me. You put symptoms together, it kind of tells you a story, doesn't it?
And we also just might have uncovered some of the skeletons lurking in the Santos family closet.
He had a temper, right?
I've never seen his temper. He grabbed his mother a couple of times by the neck. I wasn't there.
Oh.
He would have done it in front of me. But I heard about that. So he did lose his cool a couple of times.
The Sausage King is researched, written, and narrated by me, Natalia Gravich. Production, sound design, and editing by Matt Pittman. Matt Pittman, Eric Brooks, and Don Bastida are editorial producers. Special thanks to Margie Schaefer, Don Bastida, and Bijan Siavoshi for voice acting in this episode. Cover art by Dre Irabaran. Social media by Greg Wong. Jennifer Seelig is brand manager of KCBS Radio in San Francisco. The Sausage King is a production of KCBS Radio and Odyssey. Subscribe and get every episode on the Odyssey app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.